Welcome to Real World Rewind, a monthly podcast where we take a look back at some of our favorite movies from years gone by, reminding ourselves that entertainment is not mindless. Joining me this month is Joel Mayward. Hey, Joel, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks, Blaine. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. And so for this month, I let Joel pick a movie that we were going to look at. I said you could pick anything. And he picked The Kid with a Bike, which was released in 2011 and is directed by the Dardenne brothers. So I'm really excited to get to talk about this film. I'm really happy that you chose it. And I know just from following you on Twitter and Facebook and having a few conversations that you're a big fan of the Dardenne's work. Mm-hmm. And so I'm kind of curious, what draws you to their films?
I think what really draws me to their films is how they manage to take such a simple story and a simple construct and create a film that has a remarkable amount of layers and complexity and wrestles with spiritual and ethical themes and ideas that feel very timely and place-centered. Like they set all of their films in a particular location in Belgium, and yet has this timeless quality to it that you could watch any of these films and they capture your imagination kind of wherever you're at. And have a weightiness to them. There's a depth to them that I think a lot of films try to reach and aim for, and the Dardenne brothers consistently hit that moment of catharsis, particularly at the end of their films, where there's just a profound feelings, profound thoughts, and a response that I haven't really experienced in very many other films, at least this consistently. I don't think they've made a poor film yet, at least from their kind of one of the, I guess, their major film, La Promesse, The Promise, which came out in the late or the mid 90s, 1996. Mm-hmm. They have a couple of films before then. They were documentary filmmakers, and then they have a couple of releases that came out in Belgium. But that was the film that really kind of placed them on the map, and all their films since then, every single one of them, I'd consider a masterpiece. It's just a matter of which masterpiece is better than the next one. So they're filmmakers that just have such a unique style, and I think would be my favorite, at least international or non-American filmmakers working today.
Yeah, it's funny because a lot of the things that you pointed out were things that I had working around in my mind that draw me to them as well. And I will say kind of at the outset, though, my French-speaking ability is non-existent, so I'm going to butcher pronunciation for a lot of this. So everyone, please forgive me because I'm just terrible with French pronunciations.
Just go for it.
Yeah, I just go for it, and I assume that I'm somewhere in the ballpark. But yeah, I think one of the things that draws me to their films is, like you said, they're very compelling, and they're very simple. And I would almost use the word muted, and I don't mean muted with any negative connotations that might come with that. They're very muted. They're very contemplative, or they encourage contemplation. But at the same time, their films seem to me, at least, very kinetic in a way that other contemplative films might not be. So I'm thinking of things like Ozu or Simon Ling or someone like that, filmmakers like that. They're not contemplative in the sense that they feature a lot of static camera work, or even slow movement within frames. But still at the same time, they seem so stripped down in a very good way that they encourage you to just contemplate the lives of these characters. We'll probably dig in a little more into why that is later on. But yeah, I think the simplicity that that is deceptively profound is what appeals to me about their films. They have very human stories too. And at the same time, it seems to me that they resist a lot of the melodrama or a lot of the tropes that we'd see in maybe American films that are trying to do very similar things. their films kind of push against that. They push against melodrama. They push against tidying things up too neatly at the end of their films. Their climaxes are very very muted, very very distilled, especially compared to a lot of mainstream American cinema.
Yeah, they don't try to wrap things up in a bow. They let things linger and they let the story just kind of unfold. You're kind of thrown into the mix of their films, right into the middle of the story in media res, without really understanding or knowing who these characters are, what they're doing, and you have to discover that as you go along. And I like what you said about their films being kinetic. It's their cameras are not, stationary still shots. Like you said, like Ozu, or I think of Bresson, which they're highly influenced by, mm-hmm. and the comparisons are apt there. But their style feels more like almost like the camera is trying to catch up with the characters. Characters are almost always on the move. They're brooding, they're thinking, they're emoting, they're reacting, they're responding. And the camera is trying to capture all those things in a way that feels so realistic, almost documentary realistic.
Right.
And yet they're very well structured films. They're very intentional about the films that they create. You know, this isn't a documentary that they're just kind of improvising and letting the actors just kind of do their thing. There's some improvisation there, but it's still very well structured and storyboarded, and they have a clear idea of where the film is going to go without being too overly rigid or structured and perfectionistic. And that's a striking balance to have, where it feels so authentic, and yet there's such intentionality behind it when it comes to the lighting and the performances and the way that they direct their actors. So that's why I think they're so unique. They somehow manage to kind of dance between different styles and ideas without going to becoming too extreme, but also without becoming too it's not bland or boring or trying to be everything to everyone. They're very unique in their voice and their style. There's so much to say about the way that they make their films, not just the films themselves, but even the production process and mm-hmm. who they choose as actors and how that comes into play.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you mentioned, we've kind of teased out Ozu, Bresson. There are plenty of other filmmakers that they draw inspiration from. And like we've mentioned, a lot of those, Ozu, Bresson, they create much more static mm-hmm. films. And I think that a lot of the kineticism that is indicative of the Dardenne's work comes from their background as documentary filmmakers. They got their start actually doing documentary work. And it almost seems like they're pulling from some of the cinema verite trends became popular in the 1960s in France. And so their films do have a very documentary sort of feel, even though they are very well rehearsed. I know I've listened to the Dardennes talk about their production process, mm-hmm. and they rehearse months before they shoot a film, and they rehearse together with just a little handheld video camera. And they'll spend all day just plotting out movements and working through, okay, this is how we're going to shoot this, and you're going to move here now, and they'll just hash it out again and again and again until they get the look and the feel that they want. So even though, like you said, it looks like the camera's always trying to catch up with the actors, which that was a great way to put it. I'd never heard anybody put it just like that before. It's a very rehearsed trying to catch up with the actors. I mean, it's a very hard-earned and hard-fought-for sort of spontaneity that they go for.
Yeah, I think of a public speaking professor that I once had who talk to me about how to teach and how to present, and that you rehearse over and over and over and over again so that when you get up front, it just comes out naturally. You know exactly what you want to say, and thus you can improvise because you've already got that so down in your mind that you can kind of dance around with what you want to say. And I feel like the Dardennes have a very similar approach when it comes to filmmaking, in that they rehearse, they structure, they strategize so much so that when they are in the moment and and the actors are doing their thing and the cinematographers, the camera's following them around, they can improvise if they need to, but they have a good structure and a story to be working with. So they have the boundaries, kind of the guardrails in mind, but can push against those boundaries when they need to because they know where they are. And I think that kind of a filmmaking process, and just the fact that they're two directors, two writers, mm-hmm. who are doing this in such a symbiotic way. To bring in a idea from Christian theology, this Trinitarian idea of paratheresis, that there's a dance with the Trinity, with Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and all three are kind of at work and all moving and all active and present at the same time. I get that same kind of sense with the Dardenne brothers in the way that they work, where when they're on set, sometimes one's behind the camera, sometimes one is at the monitor, and sometimes they'll switch, and there doesn't necessarily seem to be a rhyme or reason behind that. Mm-hmm. And so their actors have to kind of react and respond. Which one's in charge? Is it Jean-Pierre? Is it Luke? And it's never really clear. They talk about themselves being the two-headed director, that they genuinely work as a team together. They're always listed as Jean-Pierre and Luke, so I don't know if that's just because, I don't know, alphabetical order or something like that. It could be Luke and Jean-Pierre. They genuinely do all this production together, and I think that's remarkable in a filmmaking world that is so highlights the singularity and individuality of the auteur, mm-hmm. That we have genuine auteurs doing their work together and highlighting the other in a way that's genuinely humble. And that's a remarkable thing for me too.
Yes. Yeah. Just watch, if you ever get a chance to watch, and you probably have, Joel, I'm sure, being such a big fan, just watching interviews that they do together.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just very fascinating how very, very rarely do they talk over one another. Very rarely do they disagree about something. Or seem like they clash even very much as they go through their creative process. They really do seem two-headed in that way. Their creative process is just very, very, very fascinating to me. We could talk about that for an entire podcast, really, if we wanted to. But I am curious and kind of wanting to move on and talk about Kid with a Bike now and dive into this movie that you've picked. So the Dardennes have a number of films, and like you said, they're all masterpieces, each in their own unique way. And you even mentioned La Promessa, which was the one that sort of put them on the map, as you said. And so, in a way, you would almost think maybe that's where you go if you want to just jump in and talk about a Dardenne brothers film. But you picked this one, so I'm just curious why. What draws you to this film in particular out of all their filmography?
That's a great question, because their films do all have similar themes in wrestling with working class citizens who are typically dealing with some sort of moral crisis or ethical dilemma. They're presented with an issue or problem, and there's at some point some sort of life or death scenario that happens too. So there are similar themes that happen in each of their films. But The Kid with a Bike, I think I'm drawn to it for a couple of reasons. First of all, I'm drawn to the fact that it's about a young person, and a young person who is wrestling with his own sense of being and place in the world. The film is focused on a kid with a bike, an 11-year-old boy named Surreal, and he is struggling with finding his father. He lives in a foster care home. His dad has essentially abandoned him there. There's no mention of where the mother has gone. And so being rejected by his dad, Surreal has to figure out who he really is and how to navigate this world. And I guess connect with the struggles of younger people. I'm in the youth ministry world. I've been a youth pastor for over a decade now, and so I'm drawn to that. Why The Kid with a Bike in particular, over other films, La Promesse deals with a teenager. Rosetta is all about a teen girl as well. But The Kid with a Bike, there's something just profound about the grace and the hope that comes out of Surreal's relationship with this woman, Samantha. She's a hairdresser, hairstylist, who Surreal literally runs into, bumps into, grasps onto as he's running away from his caretakers at the foster home. And she ends up essentially adopting him, bringing him into her life, into her home. And it's all just an act of mercy and grace. And there's something just beautiful about that action, and something mysterious about why she chooses to do that. At one point in the film, Surreal even asks her, "Why are you doing this?" And she can only say, "I don't know." And no other response is really given. There's no other explanation. She just does. Grace just happens. And I think it's their most gracious film in that sense. And really elicits a profound response in me of how I can be Samantha to others. How can I be somebody who is gracious and approachable and willing to care for other people the way that she does for this young boy who really treats her rudely, really lashes out against her quite often. It's all understandable, but her action and posture towards him really can only be described as mercy and grace. And I think that's what's so compelling for me and why this film always gives me a deeper sense of hope, hope in humanity, and hope in the connections that can bind us when we choose to take that path of grace and mercy.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm drawn to The Kid with a Bike for similar reasons. I mean, if I'm going to watch one of the Dardenne brothers' films, it's going to be Kid with a Bike. I mean, it's actually the one that I own. I own a couple, but it was the first one that I actually bought instead of just streaming through Hulu or mm-hmm. whatever. And part of that is because I grew up. My parents divorcing when I was very little and living back and forth with both of them, and then being raised for the second half of my life by my grandparents. So adoption is something that's very important to me, or just the idea of searching for parents, right? Father, mother. And a lot of the Dardenne brothers films deal with that. But there's something about The Kid with a Bike and the way, like you mentioned, Samantha's just freely taking in this child that speaks to me, and I think even resonates with my relationship with my grandparents who raised me. So it's just a very sort of deep personal thing that draws me to this film. I can't say that it's anything that I think is formally better or objectively better about this film than any of their others. It's just simply a personal preference.
But I can resonate with that too. I have, and I think you and I have spoken about this as well in previous conversations and podcasts about, so I have the same background of being adopted, and while I think it's a different history than yours, there is a personal connection there of it's good to see foster and adoption stories on screen that highlight the good, that highlight how this can be beneficial, and that are more complex than just the toss away joke about somebody being in foster care or adopted, or making it into, like we talked about earlier, something that's so melodramatic or the major issue. There's a lot of drama and a lot of emotion in The Kid with a Bike. And it can be quite volatile actually, mm-hmm. especially with Surreal, and the way that he treats others. He's just a red blur, constantly going, always fiery and passionate about something. He's not necessarily overly talkative, but he's very intense. And I can resonate with that as well, knowing people like Surreal, knowing young men who've been in that similar place, particularly those in the foster care system or those who have wrestled with their relationship with their parents or their guardians. So I do have a personal stake in this film, I suppose, in that I see myself in both Surreal and in Samantha. I've been both the kid and I suppose the adult looking for and trying to figure out who I am in relationship to this world, in relationship with family, what that looks like, and also the Samantha character and coming alongside someone as a pastor, as a youth worker, to try to navigate life with them, kind of pacing alongside them and helping them figure out who they are. And so there's a connection with both of those characters that I think is done so well. Their characters are so well fleshed out in this film, again, without necessarily having a ton of background as to what motivates them. That we're thrown into the mix of the story, and yet we understand why they do what they do to a point. At some point, there's a bit of a mystery of why grace just happens, but we still get a good sense of who these characters are, what motivates them, what drives them, and why they care for one another in the way that they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a moment in the film that always gets to me quite a bit. It's when Samantha Cyril and Samantha's boyfriend, I forget his name, they're in the car together. Mm-hmm. And her boyfriend, Samantha's boyfriend, says, "It's me or him."
Yeah, yeah.
And she says, "Him." That always means a lot to me because, like Cyril, I've actually had my parents tell me in word and in action at various points when I was younger that they didn't want me, like Cyril did. And that's a really painful thing to experience. So when Cyril, for the first time in his life, has someone who he doesn't even know that well say, "I choose you," right?
Mm-hmm.
Over someone that I love, over my own interests, even, you might even say, in that sense, right? I mean, like there's a relationship there between Samantha and her boyfriend. So she's choosing Cyril, even though it's not the easy choice.
And it's interesting how quickly she does that in that moment as well. In that scene, there's not this lingering hemming and hawing or wondering, should I do this? It's almost a no-brainer for her. Like, I choose him.
Mm-hmm.
And if you as the boyfriend are going to put me in that kind of a position where I have to make such a choice, that relationship, it kind of reveals maybe some of the dysfunction or brokenness inherently in that, if that's the kind of boyfriend he's going to be. And even his response of he leaves, he gets out of the car, he runs away essentially and abandons them. And she doesn't go after him. She stays with Cyril and they continue on their journey. That boyfriend is essentially out of the story from that point onward because of that profound decision that she makes. And again, we're not privy to her internal wrestling with why she chooses to do that. And yet we still can understand this is grace. This is mercy. This is what grace does to people. They make decisions like that on behalf of others, sometimes to their own self detriment. And but that sacrificial act, I think, is just, it's so remarkable and so simple. It's not, again, melodramatic or over the top in the way that it's filmed or the way that it's portrayed, but it's a deeply profound moment for both Samantha and Cyril because it solidifies that relationship. This isn't just something she's in for, you know, some sort of temporary charity case kind of thing, or just when it feels good for her, but when it hurts, she's going to be there for Cyril.
Absolutely. I want to talk about something we've been touching on very much so, and it's the idea of where you find hope or encouragement from in this film. We've mm-hmm. already been talking about this and circling around it in many ways, but I want to take a step back and sort of frame my initial experience with this film, because this film was also my introduction to the Dardenne's work, and maybe use that as a bridge point to jump in more into where we find hope in particular places in this film.
Yeah.
So I think because of the contemplative nature of their films, the Dardenne brothers' work encourages multiple viewings and almost requires multiple viewings in order to be appreciated. At least it did for me. So when I first sat down and watched The Kid with a Bike and I finished it, I enjoyed it. But I almost, on first viewing, thought it spiritually vacuous. Not in a again, I enjoyed the film. I appreciated what was going on formally, and there was something I liked about the film, but it seemed kind of empty to me. And I think one of the reasons that it did was because I grew up on a more steady diet of mainstream American comedies, romantic comedies, or even dramas like this. And this movie, like I mentioned sort of in the intro, this movie pushes against that. So, for instance, with Samantha's character, if you had in a mainstream, more conventional film, if you had a character like Samantha, there's going to be something in the first act where we establish her need, her deep-seated desire to have a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Something's wrong in her life. She feels incomplete. She feels like she's not living up to her full potential. Maybe she's just lost a partner. Maybe she had a kid and she lost, and the kid died tragically. But there's some reason that she wants a kid. And so Surreal comes along, fate comes along and pushes Surreal in her arms. And so, of course, she's just happy to take him up. And that's why she's fighting so desperately to keep him and to raise him. And that's why she loves him so much. This movie has none of that. Like you said, we get no insight into why she's taking care of him, why she's showing him this love and this compassion and this grace, why she's choosing him over her boyfriend that she's been in a relationship for at least some length of time. This movie doesn't give us any of those clues. It doesn't paint her as someone who is in need of something desperately in her life, and Surreal is the person who comes along and fills that need. So it's very unconventional in that sense. And I think because it pushes against those conventions that we can be so used to, it can feel empty. Or just then even near the climax of the film, we expect some sort of deeply moving and melodramatic conclusion. We expect Surreal and the man and his son who he robbed in that film. We expect them to, hug and tell them they forgive one another in just deep and emotional ways. And there will be a soaring score that will lead us out and we'll feel like there is redemption. And of course he doesn't do that. He, after being knocked out of the tree and we think he's dead, he miraculously gets up, right? There's almost a resurrection scene there. He gets up,
mm-hmm.
ignores them, gets on his bike, and then rides off. And that's how the film ends. So it deliberately avoids and pushes against a lot of the tropes that we can be used to, at least with more conventional films. And I think because of where I was when I saw this film for the first time, which was not terribly long after it released, I was quite a bit younger then, it felt like it was empty to me in some way. I don't feel that way now, and you don't either. So can we talk a little bit more about where specifically we find hope and encouragement in this film that avoids melodrama so much?
Yeah, I totally resonate with what you're talking about when it comes to convention. And it's a film that should feel more conventional, like there's a single woman and this needy boy and they find each other and find themselves and everything works out okay. And it's more complex than that. I think of the character in the film, there's a local gangster thug character who takes Surreal under his wing, and there's kind of a contrast of which one is the true mentor. Is it Samantha or is it this character for Surreal? And he looks almost cliche, like he's got the slicked back hair and he smokes cigarettes and he's got just kind of this tough guy attitude, and he's trying to get Surreal to do a petty crime for him. And yet there's a moment in the film where they're going back to his house and the door opens up and the gangster's mom is on the floor and he has to pick her up and he puts her back into bed and she's clearly sick somehow and he's taking care of her. And it's a moment of incredible compassion and warmth. And he realized I'm sympathizing with this guy, that he's not maybe what I expected. He's not the cliche that I thought he was. And I think the Dardennes really do that with all of their characters. There's a sense that you know where it's going to go. I know I've seen this hairdresser type before. I've seen this young troubled kid before. I think of films like The 400 Blows or Bicycle Thieves or plenty of other stories where there's a young boy, 10, 11, 12 years old, who is struggling through life, and it's a coming of age tale. And this is that. The Kid with the Bike does follow or would fall into that genre type. And yet the arc for Surreal is so different and unique, particularly when in those final moments where he doesn't retaliate against the people who've chosen to attack him or harm him, where he does just get up and walk away, and then it cuts to black and that's it. That's the end of the film. And it's very abrupt. And that follows in line with many of their other films, where the ending, the final moments, really the final 2 minutes of every Dardenne film, that something profound and deeply hopeful happens. No matter how difficult it gets, no matter how painful the circumstances have been leading up to that point, there is something hopeful and cathartic about every single one of their film's endings. Now, I haven't seen their newest film, The Unknown Girl, so I can't speak for that one. But every previous film, Rosetta, The Child, The Promise, Lorna, Silence, all these films do have this sense of hope at the very, very final frame. And it's a lingering hope. It's one that you have to contemplate. And I think, like you said, Blaine, like go back, rewatch the film and rethink and re-see the story through that lens of hope and see the way that the Dardennes have been leading up to that point. And it does feel natural and yet still profoundly mysterious. And I think they really navigate that world well, where it's very responsible and real and grounded in concrete circumstances. And yet this esoteric idea of hope, this almost transcendent or spiritual idea of hope is found there, but not in a way that we would expect from similar films with, like you said, the swelling music or the, this is the message of the film and we're going to tell you what it is kind of moment at the end. It just leaves you there to think about it. It's a process and to wonder about what do I do next? How am I supposed to respond having seen and experienced this film?
Mm-hmm. And speaking of swelling music, I was, now that I think about saying that, in a sense, this is one of the few Dardenne Brothers films that does have swelling music, because it has a musical motif, one of Beethoven's symphonies, I'm forgetting which one, that repeats it 3 or 4 times during the film, usually after a fairly intense conflict that Surreal undergoes.
Yeah, there's something unique about that, that they typically don't use music, mm-hmm. and they choose to do so in this film. They use music... like I think of Rosetta, there's a scene where two characters listen to some music on a tape for an awkwardly long period of time, but that's embedded in the film itself. This is, you know, part of the soundtrack that's emphasizing this, whatever intense scene has just happened. It does kind of force us to pause and think and reflect on what's going, like a breather in the middle of the film.
Yeah. Absolutely. I really do think this was the first time they experimented with extra diegetic, non-diegetic music. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, the use of music is almost like a Selah in the Psalms, a pause, think about this, reflect, and then keep going.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's how it strikes me. They open up an opportunity, a space that you can sort of breathe and take in all that you've seen. Because even though, like we said, these plots are very simple, the films feel so kinetic, right? The Kid with the Bike feels so kinetic. You're watching Surreal move around all the time on his bike. He's running. He's being chased. The camera work is, it's moving around. We're running around with him. It can almost feel like work at times. And so this sort of musical motif comes in and it's like, there we go. Okay. I have just a second to pause and take things in before we move on to sort of the next movement.
that might actually be, now that as you're saying that, that might be the reason why I would think The Kid with the Bike might be a good introduction to the Darden brothers films. Mm-hmm. I think of films like Rosetta or Lorna Silence, which can be very weighty, difficult films, particularly Rosetta. I remember by the end of that film being physically exhausted because of how intense and kinetic it truly was. And the amount of emotion that goes into the performance in Rosetta from all the actors, but particularly the lead who plays Rosetta, it's such an intense film. And having those pauses in The Kid with a Bike, those brief moments of respite, kind of allow you to pace yourself. And so by the end of The Kid with a Bike, I genuinely feel hopeful and restored. By the end of films like again, Rosetta or Silence, I feel, my experience has been, I felt more drained in a good way. Like I've experienced something beautiful and profound on the screen, but I need to go away and think about it and just recover. Where The Kid with a Bike, I feel a sense where I need to go out and help somebody and serve somebody and be thankful for the people that have crossed my path and brought about grace and mercy in my own life. Mm-hmm. So there's something more, not to, you know, it's so simplistic to say positive or negative feelings, but The Kid with a Bike definitely has more of a positive outlook, hopeful outlook by the end than a film like The Child or Rosetta or Lorna Silence.
Indeed. I mean, it does feel refreshing, almost in a way, like when I get done with an Ozu film or something. Because a lot of times I'll watch Ozu when I've had a really busy week and I need to just be still. I need to just be able to sit there and look at something that's not moving.
Mm-hmm,
but it's, which is kind of funny. I mean, something that's not moving when it's a motion picture. But I get a very similar feel from The Kid with a Bike, which, like you said, you don't get with all of their films, or even if you think about La Promessa, you're dealing with an actual, spoiler alert, death, not murder. And a lot of exploitation. And so there's a lot of drama and tension there, and you can feel worn out. It's really interesting to me too, how the Dardens they pointed out in interviews that this film is almost a meditation on different types of fathers. And so really, we do have different father figures in this film. You have Guy, his birth father, who's just pushing him away, doesn't want him in his life. And then you have Wes, who is the gang leader, the presumed gang leader, who is also not a good father and is very manipulative in a different way, right? He's the opposite of Guy in many ways. He, instead of pushing Cyril away, he wants to take him in, but he still just wants to take him in for his own selfish means. And then you have the boyfriend,
mm-hmm.
who obviously doesn't want anything to do with him either, because he feels like he's competing for Samantha's affections with him. And so you've got all these different father figures competing, and in the end, you can argue, I think very legitimately, that Samantha ends up becoming both the mother and the father figure. But just the fact that he doesn't ever find a father in some sense in this film reminds me, because of my past experiences, of the fatherhood of God, the fatherhood of God. Which is one of my favorite doctrines to think on and meditate on, because I lost my birth father, and it seems cliche, it seems Christianese, but all I can say is, from someone who's experienced some of these things, is that it's not. When I read through the Bible and I hear that God is my father, I still don't fully understand what that means on a functional level, but I do love it and. Need to go there more, and this movie pushes me to want to go in that direction and savor and meditate on that we have a father in God, and so that's something that always sticks out to me in here. It's also the idea that this movie seems like it focuses a lot on systems, different communication systems, networks. There are a lot of systems featured. So you've got the for instance, you've got the apartment intercom system that Cyril knows how to work.
Yeah.
There are all these supervisors at the home that he's staying in, and then he's running into the nurses and at the clinic where he meets Samantha for the first time. There's the bus system that he learns to navigate. He knows how to use. In many ways, Cyril knows how to use these systems as well as any kid his age could. He's very adept at that. But at the same time, the system itself is working against him. The system is almost geared toward injustice in many ways. So it's an individual, not a system. It's an individual working within the system. It's Samantha who ends up being able to pull him out of that, right? Out of her own inherent goodness, it seems. She's able to pull him out of that. And so it encourages me to work toward justice in that way, right? We realize that that systemic injustices exist in the world. But as Christians, we're called as individuals to work, to push back against the darkness, right? To be a force that helps spread God's glory throughout the entire earth. And so this movie encourages me to do that and forces me to think about how I fail at doing that all the time. And so I really appreciate The Kid with a Bike for that reason.
No, I totally resonate with that idea of systems and the idea of having an individual notice another individual in that system, because Samantha she's working in those systems too. She's a working class person. She's single essentially, or at least unmarried at this point. She's a hairdresser. She's not making a ton of money. And the way they're the location where they set their films, is in their hometown in Belgium. Mm-hmm. And so it's a working class town that's been hit by a number of economic crises, and they really highlight work and economics in their films. It's always this underlying theme with everything that they do. And so Samantha, in saving Cyril, she's not necessarily saving herself, because she's bringing on more responsibility to herself, more of a financial drain. And yet there is something about escaping from a system for both of them, or transcending that system in their service. And I think to a film that it makes me think of, this is a strange parallel, but it's also another favorite film of mine, is The Night of the Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of the portrayal of father figures and men and women in each film. And in The Night of the Hunter, for those who aren't familiar, it's a 1955 film about a serial killer who pretends to be a pastor and marries a widow because her husband had robbed a bank, hidden the money, and he's trying to get the money out of her and out of her kids. And the film goes down a very dark path. It's a pretty dark film. But the way that men are portrayed in that film and their inability to save the children so often, or they're a constant threat to the children. And it's in the final scenes of that film where the kids come and they're running away from Harry Powell, played by Robert Mitchum. And they come to a woman who has taken kids in, essentially an orphanage. But it doesn't seem to be like a formal orphanage, you know, that she's just kind of taking kids into her house that have run away, and she protects them. And there's a powerful confrontation near the end of the film between these two forces, between an evil man and a good woman. And I do think of that image of Samantha confronting Wes at a particular moment and taking Cyril back with her, and where Cyril really has to choose between these two people. And then a later on scene where Samantha is an advocate on Cyril's behalf to another man in Cyril's life who eventually will also try to cause him harm or also be a detriment to him, where Samantha continually is that presence. So there's a theme of God the Father that I see and that I hear you're saying, Blaine, but there's also this motherly
absolutely
picture, this parental guidance that comes from being a mom and a strong woman. And I think that there's something profound about that too, having a strong female character who's the heroine of the film, but done in such a way that's very subtle and very appropriate, and isn't, you know, this overly feminist look at the woman and how great she is kind of message. It just presents her, this is who she is, and she's incredible in the way that she acts, and just her resolve and her endurance and patience throughout the film, I think is remarkable too. So I'm with you. I think The Kid with a Bike, without necessarily spelling it out, points us to ethics that are embodied in the kingdom of God, self-sacrifice and mercy and grace and love of neighbor for one, as we love ourselves. And they never invoke the name of God or religion in the film at all. And yet there is this kind of hidden presence of God, I imagine, hovering over and in the film and in any viewer who chooses to watch it.
Absolutely. I have a quote from Luc Dardenne that I think speaks to this. He says, "We don't make films full of moral ideas to make the viewer think such and such. But we hope that people watching our films don't feel like it's the end of the world." And then he goes on to talk about how he believes that all of the films that they've made are hopeful in one way or another. And I think right now we're seeing, especially with American cinema, we're seeing an increasing trend of films that focus on small towns, which is exactly what the Dardenne brothers do. They're almost all of their films are set in this small town, Serang in Belgium. But we're seeing a lot of American films and TV series, I'm thinking of Stranger Things, that focus on small towns. And they usually include some sort of supernatural element. And so they bring the focus on how the supernatural and the extraordinary inhabits our ordinary everyday lives. And I would argue that the Dardenne brothers do the same thing in a very different, I don't want to say better, in a very different and a very, very profound way that speaks to different aspects of gospel realities. So, I mean, things like Stranger Things are great and they're fun, and I've enjoyed them a lot. So this isn't a bashing on them.
Totally.
But they're stylized. And there's nothing necessarily or inherently wrong about that. But because the Dardenne brothers' films are so unglamorous, they're not stylish. They're plain. They're ordinary. In a way that some of these other, that Stranger Things is not. I think they get at the heart of what happened when God became flesh and dwelt among us. This was not the incarnation itself wasn't a glamorous thing. It was grace and truth and light coming down, being made in human likeness. And we're talking about something that was a bloody fetus in a barnyard or a cave, like a dirty place in a town that no one cared about. And I think the Dardenne brothers get at that in The Kid with a Bike and in all of their films. Samantha is this ordinary person, right? Nothing extraordinary about her. She's a hairdresser, hardworking. But she's not Ray. She's not Furiosa. She's not any of these super women stereotypes. She's just an ordinary person in an ordinary town that we don't think about, but yet that's the vehicle through which grace comes to this child's life. And it's incredible. It's truly, I think it's every bit as extraordinary as anything we see in Stranger Things or Twin Peaks, or even things like Gravity Falls, fun series. I think it's as extraordinary as anything we see there. But it's more relatable.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think there's a good way to... There's spirituality in the Dardennes. It's a tacit spirituality. It's unspoken, and yet it's felt and seen. And there's something that's going on there where, in a show like Stranger Things, or other sci-fi stories and films that focus on small towns and these extraordinary events, there's something that's overt about that, the miraculous or the transcendent, where the Darden brothers focus on these ordinary miracles. It's a miracle to have this kind of grace or compassion for somebody. There's nothing, there's no other way to put it than miraculous. I remember showing this film to a group of teenagers, and discussing it afterwards, and they were so frustrated with Surreal, particularly in a scene where he actually physically attacks Samantha. They're fighting on the floor, and he grabs a pair of scissors and stabs her in the arm. And the teens watching it emitted a gasp, like there was an audible as this happened. And I'm watching them respond with such an emotional engagement with the film and the way that they're acting. And they're like, why doesn't she just leave him? Why doesn't she just a bit? Surreal is the worst, you know. They essentially, some of them said they got to the point where they hated the kid. And yet she continues. It's relentless, the grace that she shows, and I think that is miraculous in and of itself, way more than sci-fi monsters or aliens or other dimensions or all these other things that seem so amazing and extraordinary. It's just as extraordinary to have someone say, yes, I continue to accept you and bring you back into my life, even after you've harmed me so much. And I think that kind of message or idea might be more hopeful. So maybe I would say that it's not necessarily better, but it's a stronger idea of hope than some of these more stylized or shows and films that have that sci-fi element to it, because it is grounded in reality. Like there's something that's foundationally realistic about this, that I can see myself in Samantha. I know people like Samantha, who commit these ordinary miracles, on a daily basis. It just takes, you know, eyes to see and ears to hear, to see the ordinary, the transcendent, in the ordinary, I suppose.
Absolutely. And I do. I think there's plenty of room for both Stranger Things and the Darden brothers in our lives.
Absolutely.
And I think those are good things. But boy, am I very, very happy that the Darden brothers exist and can be a part of my cinematic diet in addition to what I'm getting from Stranger Things or Twin Peaks or things like that. I'm very happy the Darden brothers have made these films.
Me too.
And I'm very thankful for their quiet commitment to opening up these sorts of ethical questions. And I love that quote from Luc Dardenn. I know they've gone on record talking about how initially they wanted Surreal's movements with the bike to be much more violent. They wanted him to sort of beat on it and just even his pedaling action to be much more violent than it was, because it was sort of a space or an object for him to exact his frustrations and his anxieties about his parents out on. And that was too symbolic for them. They really do want to resist a lot of that symbolism, and I think they do so effectively. So it's they have a very remarkable and just completely unique style about them that I think makes them worth checking out.
Absolutely. I think particularly with the kid with a bike, but really all of their films, just the way that they communicate ethical and spiritual ideas is done in such a way that the equivalent that I think of actually is the genre of parable and the way that Jesus uses parables in his teachings. And I think Christian film critics and Christians often can talk about films as parables, but miss the point of what a parable actually is. And I'm not sure that there's always a one-to-one correspondence, because parable is just stories for illustration. It's not just trying to show a good idea and communicate a spiritual truth, but is really to subvert expectations, to take an ordinary story that communicates a radical and subversive idea that we really have to wrestle with. We should be uncomfortable after watching a parable or seeing or listening to a parable. I'm jumping all the way to these are filmic parables, right? They're films that we watch, we experience, and we have to wrestle with it's an ordinary story and yet it's communicating something profound, but I'm not entirely sure what that profundity is. I have to wrestle with that internally. I have to contemplate that. I have to rewatch the film and then try to practice some of the things that I've seen. And that's what parables do best. We chew on them. We mull over them. They percolate in our minds, and we can't quite get them out of our heads and our hearts. And I think the Dardenne brothers, in making these cinematic parables, whether they intended to or not, have crafted something that do cause us to respond morally, ethically, spiritually. I think there's a reason why Christians can celebrate these films without ever calling them a quote-unquote Christian movie.
I think that that's another reason I would heartily commend the Dardenne brothers to anybody who, to Christians especially, who have not seen their films, because it's easy for all of us, I think every single one of us to some extent, as Christians working with film, to get caught up in looking at movies and just wanting to pick out every Jesus picture that we can find.
Totally.
You know, be it through imagery, be it through narrative, whatever it is. It's just so easy to look at films and be like, and this picture's this, and this picture's this, and just want to draw those one-to-one correspondences. And the Dardenne Brothers cinema does not lend itself to that. And I think that's a very healthy thing. That's a very healthy thing for a lot of Christians, especially myself included, to remind ourselves of when we watch the Dardenne Brothers, is that not everything has to be spiritualized in order to be spiritual. Not everything has to be symbolic in order to be spiritual, in order to be filled with grace. And so that's yet another reason that I would heartily commend the Dardenne Brothers to anyone and everyone, but especially Christian viewers. Well, Joel, I've taken up plenty of your time, and I really, really do appreciate you coming on. It's always good to talk with you. You're writing all over the place all the time on the internet, so I'm going to give you just a couple minutes to plug yourself and all of your writing.
Yeah, you can visit my website, cinemaward.com, CINEMAYWARD, to find the film reviews and essays that I've written, or you can follow me on Twitter at Joel Mayward. That's probably the best way to get a hold of me on the internet. And then I've also written a book, Jesus Goes to the Movies, the Youth Ministry Film Guide, that is about discussing film and its connection with teenagers and ministry and discipleship. And so whether you're a youth worker or not, I think it's a book that can be accessible and explore these ideas of what film, the power of film, and the theological and spiritual ideas that it can communicate and force us to wrestle with. But thanks so much, Blaine, for inviting me to talk about one of my favorite movies and to just be an awesome conversation partner. And I hope that people go out and watch The Kid with a Bike or seek out other Dardenne Brothers films. They're readily available. There's at least one streaming on Netflix, I think, at the moment, 2 Days, 1 Night, and other places. Check them out. The Dardennes are awesome.
Absolutely. You can find me on Twitter. You can also find me writing at Real World Theology or at Christ and Pop Culture. So thanks to everyone who listened for taking time out of your week. And until next time, thanks for rewinding with us. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!